Okay, here, let me start with this one. Naomi. With the bailout, the perpetual bailout, in effect, and the concentration of ownership now increasing to 1% owning 95%, how can we, the people, present and minimize this shock? The shock is underlined there, and begin a resistance to serve the people against corporate interest.
Look, I mean, I don't think there's any kind of magic answer, and I'm willing to bet that everybody in this room really knows the answer. It's organizing. And, you know, we have, if we remember our history in this country, we have a very rich history to draw on. What we've been living through, this corporate liberation movement, is a counter-revolution against the New Deal. We say that all the time. We know that, right? But it is a counter-revolution against the gains that were made by progressive organizations after another shock. A shock, we keep hearing, this is the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. Well, I hope very much that it doesn't get as bad as the Great Depression. But what happened after that shock, after the market crash of 1929, is that people understood that this was a failure of the market system, and they correctly named it as such. And they said that the people who created the problem were not going to be the same people who solved the problem. And, you know, we live with a history that is incredibly distorted. It's the great man theory of history, which tells us that we got the New Deal because FDR was a nice guy and he handed it to us, right? And that is not what happened. And this is why it's so important to move the center. The New Deal was a compromise, and it was a compromise because people were so radicalized in this country, and they were organizing. They were organizing in trade unions. They were shutting down entire cities with general strikes. They were organizing against foreclosures in neighborhood organizations. You know, this is the history that Howard Zinn tells, that Francis Fox Piven tells, about neighborhood organizations when people were being thrown out of their homes. Their neighbors would gather together and physically move the furniture back into their homes, and that's how they got rent control in New York City. That's how they got housing projects in New Orleans. These are how all the housing victories were won, right? And it's been an undoing of those victories that we've been living, whether it's the closing of New Orleans projects, the very idea of the subprime mortgages, because the only acceptable way to get people into homes is, you know, is through speculative finance. So their model is bankrupt, and that is an opportunity for us to remember the conditions that brought about those tremendous progressive victories. And let's remember, people wanted more than that. Right? Upton Sinclair met with FDR, and he said, we don't want your charity, your New Deal charity. We want workers' co-ops across this country so we don't have to rely on handouts, right? These are the types of conditions that won single-payer health care in Canada. So, you know, there is, what we know is that it won't be handed to us. That's what we know, that there's no shortcuts, and that we have these opportunities to organize across communities and to organize in ways that actually directly improve people's lives. There's something very dangerous about what's happened. The elites are refusing to pay their debts, right? They're having their debts erased before our eyes. This isn't a gift to organizers, right? I mean, imagine the organizing that could be done around student loans, around credit card debt. This is dangerous. This is dangerous what they've done. And the only question is, are we going to have the courage to meet this moment?
Okay, here's our second question. Naomi, I know you have said the best way to resist the shock is to stay informed. What resources have you found to be the most credible, reliable, and unbiased with the current state of our media? Sometimes it's hard to decipher.
Well, Democracy Now. Yeah. You know, I can tell you who some of the analysts who I've been really relying on in this period, just writers who you can read on Common Dreams, you can read on Counterpunch. Nomi Prinz, former investment banker turned whistleblower. She's awesome. She used to work at Bear Stearns. She tells the truth. Bill Gross at The Nation, who wrote the definitive history of the Federal Reserve. You don't think so? Bill is great. He's been doing great analysis. Dean Baker, wonderful economist, has really been keeping a very close eye on the bailout. He's been doing great reporting. Michael Hudson, who was Dennis Kucinich's advisor, economic advisor, also a former Wall Street turned whistleblower. He's been doing phenomenal analysis about the shocks to come. Nader's been doing great stuff, as we know. And wouldn't have been amazing if Nader had been allowed in those debates to talk about these issues, right? That's a start.
Okay, thank you.
We have a lot of these resources on our website, shockdoctrine.org, I'm working on a piece right now that'll be bringing out a lot of information about the bailout, and we're going to have a resource section linking to all of the original source material that I'm drawing on as well.
I can't resist asking, what do you think about Comedy Central?
I think they've been particularly good on the bailout.
Yeah.
I mean, I was on Colbert 2 weeks ago, and that was a great show because before, I don't know if people saw the segment before I was on, which was Stephen debating himself, formidable opponent, about the bailout. If you haven't seen it, search on that. Search on Colbert on the bailout.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Here's the third question: is a Democratic president and are a Democratic president in Congress enough to turn the country around, or is the Friedman deal already sealed?
Look, I mean, this is the point. It's a bad situation. All right. Look, but it is a moment where. Already we have seen Obama have to move substantially to the left to meet this moment. I mean, what he's saying now about deregulation and trickle-down economics is not what he was saying at the start of this campaign, right? So the task is actually a good one. It's to try to take that rhetoric and turn it into reality, right? You know, they're afraid of what this moment represents. Obviously, there are limits to what you can do with a candidate who is funded by Wall Street. But the point is you want to create a dynamic which is like the dynamic that FDR had, where people were so radicalized, and yes, they were organized in third parties as well. And he was able to say that sell the New Deal to the elites because the alternative looked like revolution. Right? I mean, and you have to, that's the dynamic where change happens in this country. That said, the first demand has to be campaign finance reform, but real campaign finance reform, including media reform and access to the public airwaves, right? I mean, this country, do you understand that in my country, we had elections, okay? They started in September and were finished in October. I mean, the elections never end in this country. Do people remember that this is not normal? It's not just that the elections are so incredibly expensive. It's that they also constantly defer the moment of real politics, right? One of the reasons why this bailout is as corrupt as it is because Congress is missing in action, right? They did a little bit of good stuff in there, managed to get a little clause in there giving the Treasury Secretary the ability to negotiate for equity, which was the only good thing that they managed to do. And now that's actually what they're using to do the equity buys. But nobody's overseeing this because everybody's in election mode like they almost always are, right? So, you know, the elections have to be way shorter, way, way shorter, and way cheaper, way cheaper.
By the way, I just noticed that one of these cards is not a question. It is a reminder. And let me read it just very quickly. Ruth Hiller, a founder of New People, is here tonight, and we'd like to express our welcome to her as well. Okay. New profile, excuse me. Well, New people is not so bad either, right? New profile, new people. Okay. With the financial collapse taking place in the U.S., Europe and Asia, is a new global economic order possible? And maybe new there means humane.
Yeah, well, like a humane we are seeing this coordination between European governments. And, you know, it is interesting that to the extent to which Paulson was forced to modify the original Plan A, it was because of what was happening in Europe. You know, I think obviously there has to be some international coordination once you have a globalized economy, and when you have these shocks that just reverberate around the world, it is an opportunity when you could advance something like the Tobin tax, which is a tax on currency speculation, and the idea of it is to slow down the casino. And this is actually something that could be done preemptively in this moment, because it is only a matter of time before. You know, I'm talking about how we've had the market shock, now we're going to have the budget shock, and then we're going to have the currency traders come in and start punishing currencies where they think that countries aren't going to be able to back up the promises that they've made. So slowing down currency speculation is very important. Taxes on trading is also important. But the point is, you know, the financial sector has been getting away with this by pitting governments against each other. As soon as you try regulating the U.S. banks, they say we'll all move to London because they have looser regulation. So this is a moment when you can demand a good kind of coordination to shut down the tax havens, to actually get the key markets coordinating their regulations so that the banks aren't able to pit countries against each other. I think we're a ways from that, to be honest. I think we can see what some progressive legislation would be, but I'm afraid that people are getting a little bit fooled by their rhetoric, right? Like Sarkozy in France is using a lot of very progressive rhetoric to talk about, you know, taking on American capitalism. But Sarkozy is, you know, he was saying that he was going to be France's Margaret Thatcher a month ago, mm-hmm. right? This is not someone who can be trusted. Somebody, you know, thinking about somebody else who's been making a lot of sense lately is Ken Livingston, the former mayor of London, Red Ken. Mm-hmm. He unfortunately lost the elections, and he lost them because the popularity of the Labour Party is so low because of Blair that Livingston really was taken down with them. And so he is now the voice of the left of the Labour Party. And he's been doing some great critiques of Gordon Brown, and talking about all the things more that he could be doing, but also talking about this moment. The way Ken Livingston is describing this moment, he says this is the opportunity of a generation to be able to have control over the banks and have these revenue streams. I mean, that's the other point about a Tobin tax or a tax on trading, right? We need to think about how we're going to pay for the future we want now that they've dumped this mess on our laps. We have to find ways to get more tax dollars out of these global elites that are able to hide their money so easily. And that has to be the goal.
Well, there's a question here that actually fits very well with what you just said. Shocks can swing many ways. The Birmingham church bombing spurred the civil rights movement. The invasion of Cambodia, campus shootings led to nationwide student uprisings. Doesn't everyone try to use shocking events to advantage? And I think that to mean progressive advantage in some cases. Please clarify.
Yeah. Well, I think the way I discuss it in the book is that this really is about democracy. Neoliberals are not the only people to use shocks undemocratically. The far left has done it. That's why Joseph Stiglitz calls the shock therapists in Russia market Bolsheviks. And fascists certainly have used shocks, deliberate shocks, to push through their policies. But what we need to, you know, and nobody is arguing that you don't respond to a crisis, that you don't respond to a disaster. I mean, some of the disasters that we're talking about are just disasters, right? Like the tsunami, there's, you know, nothing caused it. But overwhelmingly, the shocks that we're talking about are failures of the system. They're messages. They're telling us that there is something wrong, that the market system cannot be left to regulate itself, that the climate is furious, and we need to respond to these. We need to respond to these crises. We need to respond to these messages. But the question is, do we respond to them by concentrating power in the hands of the elites and pushing through unpopular policies, or do we respond to them by democratizing our society and creating more space? We really have these two choices, and this is why it is worth remembering the real history of what created the New Deal, because that's a counterexample. It's an example of disaster populism or disaster collectivism, where you had a crisis and people didn't regress. They trusted themselves. They found new courage. They opened up democratic spaces. More people entered the political process. And so, you know, the goal is to, you know, identify that there really are these two ways of responding to a crisis. There's the regression response, where you trust the great leader, and that's what makes you very vulnerable to these fascist tendencies. Or there is the counter response to crisis, which we know from our personal crises as well, which is you find reserves of strength and courage and maturity that you didn't know that you had. And that, as progressives, that's the space that we're aiming for, right? So it isn't a question of does everybody take advantage of a crisis. It's a question of are we going to meet these inevitable crises with regression or with maturity, with concentration of power or with democracy? And those are the choices that we face.
Thank you. By the way, let me know when you're getting ready to
fall down. I'll take a couple more.
Okay.
Because I think it was promised that I was signing every single one of your books.
Yeah, okay. There are two Gordon Brown questions. One of them is very impressive. It's typewritten and about almost a page long.
Isn't
I don't know who's able to do that, but I've never seen a
Did you bring a typewriter?
Read it. Gordon Brown has been a supporter of many Milton Friedman's ideas, even writing letters back and forth during the last years of Friedman's life. Brown has been saying for several years that this period in history will bring about unprecedented restructuring of the global economy. In light of recent events and Brown's prior position as Chancellor of the Exchequer, do you believe there has been a coordinated effort to bring about the current global economic crisis in order to push through an otherwise unpopular economic policy? And by the way, there's another one like it. As a British citizen, I know that Gordon Brown is absolutely not a socialist, so what is his motivation?
I don't know what's motivating Gordon Brown. I think part of what's motivating Gordon Brown is the same thing that's motivating Barack Obama, which is they have seen that this crisis is saving their political butts, okay? I mean, Barack Obama was about to lose the election, and so was Gordon Brown. Gordon Brown's ratings were so low. They were writing his political obituaries in The Guardian every day. He was facing a coup within the Labour Party and was going to be replaced by David Miliband, who is a Blairite, worse than Blair. It was over for Brown. And he has been resuscitated by this decision to use this rhetoric, which has been, which people are eating up. And the point is it possible to now that we know that these are the most popular policies, because this is why these politicians are using this rhetoric, is because all of their polling is telling them that this is what people want to hear, and have the confidence to say, okay, we've heard the rhetoric, now we want the reality, all right? But that's what's motivating Brown. He is seeing his political fortunes transformed. The more he talks like his old socialist self, the more his popularity rises. That's what's happening with Brown, all right? No, I don't believe they planned this. No, okay? look, there is an extraordinary comfort level with crisis. I don't believe they planned it, but I also don't buy for a second that this took them by surprise, right? I don't buy for a second, Alan Greenspan, who made a series of decisions to refuse all attempts to regulate this sector. And now he says the one thing that he didn't account for is the dishonesty of bankers. That is his statement. You know, This bubble inflated because it made a lot of people very rich. That's why this bubble inflated, and that's why they didn't stop it, because they were rewarded for not stopping it, okay? And anyone with a brain could see that bubbles burst. They're filled with air. That's why they're called bubbles. But there was a comfort level with it, because, you know, I think the people at the center of it were prepared, right? The bankers, this is what Michael Hudson writes about. This is the way the whole remuneration structure, these extraordinary paydays that the bankers give themselves, they're protecting themselves against the bursting of the bubble. They're acting as if the party's going to end any day. That's why they pay themselves those bonuses, and that's why they negotiate themselves those golden parachutes. So it's not that they didn't know that this could happen. They're the only ones who prepared.
You've been very generous with your time. Can we ask just one more question,
sure.
And we'll call it, and then you get to sign all those books. Given the shock that we are in today in the United States, what can unions and working people do to insist and ensure that their voices are heard and acted upon?
Yeah, well, look, it's a great question. And it's tied to a lot of the questions that came earlier. You know, one of the real tragedies right now is that the labor movement is pouring its precious resources into buying television ads and corporate media for Barack Obama. And that is money that could be spent on public education, on organizing. It's a travesty. Those ads should be free. They're the public airwaves, right? So it's all interconnected. It's connected with media reform. It's connected with campaign finance reform. If Obama wins, it is going to be easier to organize in this country. That is one substantial difference. You know, I think that there will be a renewal of organizing, and I think that the onus is really on members of unions to put pressure on their leadership, because they can't be trusted any more than the leadership of the Democratic Party. And by the way, it's very hard to tell the difference. And to say that this is unacceptable and that the next campaign is for campaign finance, for media reform, and that money has to be going directly to increasing their membership and fighting for labor rights. It's outrageous, this subsidy of the workers of this country to corporate media, a corporate media that systematically ignores the voices of workers in this country. It's been fun. Thank you, guys. Take care. I want to thank all the organizers again. It's been really, really wonderful to be with you tonight.